supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you this week, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we're going to try to take on Japanese knotweed, one of the most invasive plants frustrating gardeners and homeowners right now. We're also going to talk to Chelsea Fields from the Cook's Garden about what they're doing on a rugged Pennsylvania mountaintop to increase the oil content of herbs and make them even more scrumptiddlyumptious. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, John. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
And where is John Great?
We're here in Gorham, Louisiana, in Natchitoches Parish, Louisiana.
What part of Louisiana are you in?
I would almost say central, north central.
Okay, very good. Okay, what can we do for John in Louisiana?
My question for you today is I have about a 3.5-acre plot that I mow, and that I'm not wanting to mow it any longer, and I'm wanting to plant an indigenous pine tree species, the loblolly pine.
Mm-hmm.
And my question for you is, how far apart do I plant these seedlings so they'll grow fairly well? I'm not going to harvest them or anything. I just wanted a local plant that'll grow here without any trouble. I won't have to fool with it. The thing will just take off and grow. I have terrible soil. I actually have white clay for mm-hmm. ground and maybe 1 inch of topsoil, if you would even call it that.
Well, they are massive trees when they achieve full size. I'd want to have them at least 20 feet apart. You say you have starts of some kind available to you?
Yes, sir. I'll buy the seedlings.
And these are just little baby things. These are like 8 inches to a foot tall.
That's correct, sir.
So you say you don't want to mow it anymore. Is it weeds? Is it Bermuda grass? What is it?
It's Bermuda grass, but it gets so hot and dry here in the summer, come June, July, August, September, the grass is just fried, and I'm not even cutting it, and it still just burns up, and it's just too much to water.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. First of all, I want these trees to go into the ground in the fall. That's when they're going to have their best chance of establishing. Because if your summers are so hot, it's burning up Bermuda grass. You know, that's almost like the punchline to a bad joke. That's like, how hot is it down there, John? It's so hot, the Bermuda grass is dead. I mean, that's, you know.
Oh, I understand.
So the first.
It gets extremely hot and extremely dry for long periods of time.
Right, but you have good moisture in the fall, over the winter, and in the spring.
Yes, sir.
Right. So no matter what season or year, I should say, that we're going to do this, we're going to put these things in the ground, I'm thinking, around September 1st. Their survival rate will be quadrupled. Now, you know, when they're small, they're still tasty and delicious. What do you have that would like to eat your baby loblolly pines? Do you have rabbits? Do you have deer? Things like that?
Yes, sir. We have everything. We live in the national forest.
Right.
And we have every kind of critter one could ever think of here.
So yes, the bigger trees you start with, the better this is going to work. If you can buy starts that are maybe 2-3 years old, you know, saplings instead of these little baby things, that would be a worthwhile investment. If not, if you're just going to buy these little shoots, I would pot them up into pots that I could protect. You know, maybe rig up an outdoor cage in a place that gets some sun and some shade and plant these little things in each in its own pot. if you wanted to do it that way, I would carry them through to at least the following fall. If you get, if you can get nice size ones, 2-3 feet tall, then certainly plant them this fall. You want to dig a wide hole, not a deep one. You want to plant them fairly shallow, even especially with that clay you have. Don't improve the soil in the hole. You can spread some compost around the surface after you've got them done planting. And then you're going to invest in, like, chicken wire or animal fencing. You're going to be buying it by the 200-foot roll because these things have to be inside little cages for the first couple years of their life. But after they get to be 4 or 5 years old, you know, they're going to be nice and woody. And then they won't be delicacies anymore. But when they're young, grazing animals will eat them. But
well, that's great information, and I'll definitely act on it.
Yep, definitely planting in the fall, is, and then you're not going to have to worry about taking care of these things. Nature will take care of them for you. It may seem backwards, but that's going to be the natural rhythm for these things having great success.
Well, look, I really like your show, and I listen to it every Saturday, and I like your command of the English language.
All right, John, thank you so much. That's very sweet of you to say, sir.
And y'all have a great one.
You too, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Matt, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am just fine, sir. And where is Matt well?
In Adamstown, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for Matt in Adamstown?
Well, I'm a kind of budding amateur gardener and composter, and very, very limited results on the composting. And I have access to roughly a 20-gallon container of coffee grounds every 3-4 weeks and almost unlimited spent barley. And I was wondering if there's some way I can compost this or use this in my garden / flower beds to my advantage.
Well, it's easy to figure out where you would get coffee grounds. You're getting that from an office or a coffee shop or a restaurant.
A coffee roaster, local, yeah.
Oh, a local coffee roaster. So are you actually getting coffee grounds?
I'm getting spent grounds from his little coffee shop, and then also the chaff and some unused grounds from the roasting process.
And that's interesting. That could be valuable schmutz. And then the barley, is that from a home brewer or brew pub? Or
from a brew pub.
And that's wet and heavy, right?
That is wet and heavy.
And I guess the coffee grounds are wet and heavy.
The ones that have been used, yes.
So do you get the chaff separately?
The chaff is actually light and fluffy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the main component of any compost needs to be dried brown materials, ideally fall leaves. Some people in a situation like yours, where you are faced with this abundance of very high quality, very nutritious natural materials, will sometime buy straw or find old spoiled bales of straw and use that as their dry browns.
Can I use the straw from my chicken beds?
Yes, the straw from your chicken beds is also going to have a lot of nitrogen-rich poultry manure in it, right?
Yes.
We could have an explosive compost pile here. I mean, you have an abundance of raw materials. What you need more of is dry browns. And do you have anything to shred all this? Obviously, the coffee grounds and the barley and everything, that doesn't need to be shredded. But the chicken bedding is probably still pretty firm.
I have a small home chipper shredder.
Good, good, good. And so you can run that stuff through the hopper.
Mm-hmm.
Did you save any fall leaves?
We don't really have trees around us.
Oh, nonsense.
Save the leaves.
Nonsense. You're in Pennsylvania. It's one of the most forested places on the planet. How can you not have trees? Does your community pick up leaves at the curbside or anything?
Yes.
You want to talk to the people who run the trucks, and you want them to bring you a massive amount of leaves. And then what you want to do is you want to shred up your used chicken bedding. And then you want to mix all four things together. You want to, and you really want to mix them. You don't want to layer them. You want like 3/4 shredded leaves, lots of coffee grounds, lots of this barley, a good amount of your shredded chicken bedding. And this is the kind of compost because of the nitrogen rich components. I know the coffee grounds are nitrogen rich. Everybody knows chicken manure is one of the most nitrogen rich things on the planet. The barley is going to have, you know, it's going to have some carbon, it's going to have some nitrogen. But the combination of these things is not only going to make you premium compost, it's going to make it super fast. This is a pile that's going to really cook up and steam and reduce in size by half. If you do this right, you'd have finished compost on the bottom in 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. This is like atomic compost in a good sense.
I'm happy to hear that.
All you got to do is arrange for that leaf litter to be delivered to your house, and you are off to the races. Save some compost for me.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, man. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who enjoys fresh salad greens that the warm weather that is the bitter enemy of lettuce, spinach, and such is on the way. Sowing a fresh and last run now is the best way to ensure a few more weeks of extra good eating, especially if this spot gets some nice afternoon shade. Just don't go sowing your red sails in the sunset just yet, because we'll be right back with the story behind mountaintop-grown herbs and what to do if Japanese knotweed comes your way, and lots more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, Japanese knotweed, perhaps the least wanted invasive plant making its way around the country. What can you do if this monster shows up in your yard? We will tell you in the question of the week. We'll also take more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome Chelsea Fields from the Cook's Garden, who is here to talk to us not only about herb growing, but about a very special herb farm that is said to produce superior varieties of these favorite plants. And in the interest of full disclosure, the Cook's Garden is a division of Burpee, who are underwriters of our show. Chelsea, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you here. Chelsea Fields, and that's got to be a phony name you invented just to get a job in horticulture, right?
I can't say it does any harm having a last name like that.
There you go. So tell us a story. These herbs that you've all brought here today, we're holding the microphone up so people can see them on the radio. Obviously, everybody loves herbs. I think herbs are the new heirlooms. Everybody's talking about, you know, if you just want a garden and you don't want to go to a lot of trouble, but you want a lot of success, grow herbs and herbs and more herbs. Mm-hmm. And these herbs are somewhat special in that they were propagated under conditions much like fine wine grapes.
That's correct. These herbs were grown in the absolute best soil, best sunlight, best climate that you can have for really flavorful, aromatic herbs.
And this is, however, on a godforsaken mountain in a godforsaken section of western Pennsylvania, where I'm led to believe that if you Google map it, all you see is the herbs.
That's right. We've fully taken over the mountain now with our herb production.
And these are called pinnacle herbs, right?
That's correct.
And obviously the pinnacle refers to the mountain. What's so special about growing herbs on a mountaintop?
Well, these herbs are, first of all, they're grown in a really nice natural soil that has a really high nutrient content. So that's going to help concentrate a lot of the aromatic oils in the leaves. Next, they're fed with spring water. Having the spring water be nutrient rich, have a lot of micro and macronutrients, again, it's just going to donate to that huge fragrant content in the leaves. And finally, being on a mountaintop, so they're full sun, they're exposed to wind. These are hardy, hardy herbs, and they're tough, and they're going to be ready to go right in the garden and grow well for you.
So it's your experience that these pinnacle herbs are more defiant of brown thumbs?
That's exactly right. Yep. It's a green thumb in a container.
Now, you've brought the studio is overwhelmed by the smell of these chives that have kind of exploded. Their little seed pods have exploded. And you call this cha-cha chives? Do they get up and dance? Is the mountain that good?
Well, the chive top, the new flowers, like you're saying, that are exploding, is kind of like the flowing skirts of a nice cha-cha dancer.
Okay. And this chive is part of the Pinnacle collection?
It is, yeah. It was a new development bred by Burpee Breeders this year. And instead of having flowers on top, it's just more chives and more chives and more chives. So the whole thing is fully harvested and edible.
Right. Instead of flowers coming out of the seed pods on top, it almost looks like a grassy herb coming out. Yeah. Oh, and it's very delicate flavor, mm-hmm. So you could just chop these up and chive away. This would be a milder chive than the bottom part, right?
Yeah, it's like a mild micro chive. And much like your onion chives, it flowers in the spring.
Let's see. You brought us a whole bunch of lemon-scented herbs, which obviously are some of my favorites. Because as I'm always trying to explain to our listeners, any lemon-scented herb, if you crush it up and rub it on your skin, is a very effective mosquito repellent. And I think, do you and I both have the golden variegated thyme in front of us?
Yes, we do.
And this is just such a great smell. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful little plant. These plants are at least lemon-scented thyme in general. Has been found to be the most effective of the lemon-scented herbs when crushed up and rubbed on the skin as a mosquito repellent. The more we play with these, these do have a lot of oils in them, don't they?
They do.
But now we've ruined ourselves for the other girls here. How are we going to?
Well, they'll all stand up there separately.
The lemon, I'm serious. This is much more heavily lemon-scented than the lemon-scented thyme that I have growing at home.
Excellent.
And you're saying that that's the effect of this terroir that they are.
Yeah, exactly. Everything that we do in growing these is to concentrate the oils in the plant so that you have this really huge pop of pungency.
And that is poppy. And this is a great rock garden plant. It's a great plant to trail over. I always tell people if they're going to grow tomatoes in containers, mm-hmm. only one tomato mm-hmm. plant per container. But you can plant a lot of girly stuff. Sure. Around the edges, mm-hmm. and this lemon thyme will trail.
Exactly. And you mentioned this for rock gardens. I really like it for anything underfoot, because once you're agitating it, if you're walking over it or trailing your hand by it, again, you get that nice hit of lemon out in the garden.
And then I got tarragon.
Tarragon, yes.
Is that one of your favorites?
I think the tarragon is just so earthy and green. It's great for, you know, a lot of proteins, a lot of white meat. You can even do a little bit of lamb with it.
One of my absolute favorite plants of all time, pineapple sage.
Me too.
And first of all, it's a trick plant. Mm-hmm. You know, you can bring people into your garden and you can say, close your eyes, and you go like this. And they go, you got a pineapple down there. The leaves are pineapple. The leaves are more pineapple-y than a true pineapple.
Yeah, they are dead on. They're really sweet and bright.
But the impressive thing is if you let this herb go to flower.
Yeah, I mean, it's this vibrant crimson red flower on chartreuse foliage, and the plant gets to be 3 or 4 feet tall.
But if you allow that, won't that negate somewhat the flavor of the herb, of the leaves themselves? Once a plant goes to flower, with very few exceptions, you don't want to use the leaves for cooking anymore.
No, that's an excellent point. It starts to change the flavor profile of the herbs. They usually start to get a little bit bitter or sour. But at that point, I usually just start bringing them in for cut flower containers in my house. I start making arrangements out of the herbs and just kind of transition with the herbs themselves.
Because I've seen you've cut these back, presumably to prevent flowering so that you could still get these great oils. And mm-hmm. that's it. And that's obviously a trick that you can do mm-hmm. is the early growth. You can keep cutting it back, like you have to do with basil. Basil right. is born wanting to flower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by cutting it back, you're also creating a bushier plant. So you're going to have really nice branching. You're not going to get herbs that are, you know, overgrown and kind of falling all over themselves.
Now, we have one other herb here, and you blew me away with this, and maybe it's just my lack of gardening experience. It looks a little bit like a pale rosemary, mm-hmm. right?
Yep. It's silvery, almost like a lavender even.
But it's curry. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if somebody had come up to me at a party and gone, you know, where do they get curry? I'd go, isn't it the leaves of some tropical tree or something?
Right. Well, full disclosure, most curry is actually a spice blend. This is not edible, but it carries the scent of a curry.
Oh, so it's incredibly curry-icious. I mean, why is it not edible?
Just because of kind of the oils and the leaves, it doesn't really lend itself. It kind of bitters up in cooking, but it's an excellent fragrance additive to your herb garden. Again, you walk by and you have this, you know, Mediterranean, Indian earthiness that you can have in your garden.
At least the Pinnacle line of herbs are only available from the cook's garden. And they're only available as live plants, right?
That's
correct. You don't collect the seeds from them and do like a Pinnacle seed collection, hint, hint. You know?
we really do. We have a good amount of seeds available of herbs. It's a great time to direct sow your herbs. Once you get into some of the more unique things like this curry, they're not available from seed.
A lot of the better herbs you really need to start with cuttings.
Right. But, you know, seed is a good place to start if you miss the boat on the plants. Start with the seed and come back around to them for the next season.
Well, and what a great concept, too, to take this unique terroir mm-hmm. and use it to grow a line of plants. And I guess you really have chosen the plants that kind of concentration can benefit. There seems to me to be a good corollary between concentrating the sugars and natural flavors in wine grapes mm-hmm. and concentrating the essential oils that are herbs. I mean, without the oils, we got no show.
That's right. And, you know, the micro and macronutrients, again, I mean, that's what gives these their huge pop of flavor and scent. And then all of the other environmental aspects just are icing on the terroir cake.
Well, these are beautiful plants. My sensory my sensory levels are overloaded. All right. Chelsea Fields has joined us from the Cook's Garden to talk about their fabulous Pinnacle line of herbs, and to remind everybody that it's not too late to go out and get some herbs or start some herbs from seed. But when we get around to plant picking time next season, you might want to check these out.
Thank you. And right now the line is about 32 varieties long, and we're adding every season.
All right, Chelsea, thanks for coming in and bringing your herbs to You Bet Your Garden.
Again, thanks for having me. I had a great time.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kira, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Kira. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Thank you. And where is Kira great?
I am in Claymont, Delaware.
Oh, okay. I know where that is. That's a very nice area. What can we do for Kira and Claymont?
Well, I'm renting a property, and I moved in, I guess, a year and a half ago. And according to the old Google map pictures, the yard was completely overgrown. The fence line was awful. We started trimming everything back and pulling out what we could. Really noticed two kinds of weeds that are really, really terrible. These vines that grow maybe 30 or 40 feet long, and they come from basically small tree trunks. And also a pokeweed, which has really, really awful roots. And I've dug out as much as possible, but I don't know if there's anything else I can be doing to try to keep these things gone and get rid of them after I've planted things around them. And
well, it is dicey to plant things around them. No matter what you do with these kind of weeds, they are long-term projects. So that's why you're doing all this free forced labor, is you want to have some little gardens of your own.
Yeah.
Now, are your only possibilities for gardens around where the roots of the pokeweed and the vines are?
I did some small raised beds, but my whole backyard is shade, and most of the rest of the yard is all sort of on an angle coming mm-hmm. down. So, I mean, I've gotten some roots out that are maybe 3 or 4 feet long, and I've really just dug out as much as I possibly can. But every once in a while, I still notice something coming out from a piece of root that I miss.
Right. And this is the only sunny spot.
Pretty much.
But just by getting rid of these weeds, you've clearly improved things.
Oh, yeah. It looks a lot better. A lot better. I'm just worried about, you know, having missed some and having them come back and trying to see if I can get rid of some more of them in nice manners, you know.
Right.
I think my boyfriend sprayed some Roundup on them last year, but that didn't even dent most of them.
Exactly. And it's a danger to you, to him, and to amphibians. That's not the right way to go about it. You know, one thing I can tell you from having been the editor of Organic Gardening for 7 years, being on this show for 14 years, the vast majority of my emails concerning herbicides are that they didn't work. And now people are ready to go organic. And it's like, if only you hadn't killed all those frogs and toads first. So, yes, sin no more. And your idea of the manual control, it's exhausting. It sounds like you've won 90% of the battle.
Yeah, I mean, most of it is gone, but the vines just grow so quickly. You know, they'll just come out of nowhere.
Right, and it sounds like it might be wild grape, which is a really tenacious vine. One of the things that climate scientists are saying is the climate change is favoring these weedy vines more than any other plant. Now, what do you want to grow in this sunny area?
Well, I was trying to grow some garden beans along the fence. I was trying to put in a few blackberry brambles.
Now, those are radically different plants. You know, the blackberries mm-hmm. themselves, some people consider invasive. They're not going to stay put. Blackberry vines travel by underground rhizomes. And if you're renting, you would need to get permission to plant something that long-lived, I would think. Because they're never going to go away. They're just going to keep spreading their territory, and they will grow abundantly. And if you think the pokeweed comes up in crazy places, where do you see where the blackberries come up?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be very careful, because most of the blackberry varieties are very thorny. There is a variety called Doyle's Thornless. It doesn't have the big thorns. But they are not well-behaved plants. So, you know, that's a little difficult to think about fruits other than strawberries, for instance, in a rental house, because that's the kind of stuff you're going to leave behind, and not everybody wants blackberries. But you could grow a very nice little veggie garden. See, one of the problems is these weeds appeared on the fence line because birds deposited the seed there after sitting on the fence. You're hoping to use the fence for free trellising, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Why don't we move away from the fence by about a foot? Make it 2 feet so you can walk behind it. And what I want you to do is level out the soil and then just have you and your partner or whoever just knock out a nice growing box. No bottom to it, just a foot high, 4 foot wide, no wider than 4 feet. It can be 4 or 8 feet long. And before you put this on the ground, lay down single sheets of cardboard on top of the soil. And then fill the box with half compost and half real nice topsoil. And then grow in the box. The vine may come up outside the box. And the smart money might say, continue the cardboard to the fence and then cover that cardboard with a couple inches of wood chips. But the fence is always going to be problematic. It's very difficult to control weeds coming up through a fence because they got so many places their roots can get purchased. But if you come in 2 feet, you probably still have the sun. You can fill this box. The cardboard will protect it. You'll grow fabulous in it all summer long. Then when and if you guys move, you take your box with you.
So just keep digging stuff out along the fence and move elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, and over at the fence, after you dig out the next run, I would get, this is a great use for wood chips or shredded bark mulch, just get it delivered and just pile it a foot deep along the bottom of the fence and really smother the vine. And that way, okay, if you see these things coming up again, just clip them off. They'll be incredibly weak from having to grow up through all that mulch.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, Kira.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear on Sunday, June 9th at the 20th Annual Earth Fair in Smithville, New Jersey, dishing the dirt and answering your garden questions at noon and 2. That's the 20th Annual Earth Fair in Smithville, New Jersey on Sunday, June 9th. And on Saturday, June 15th, the legendary Elaine Ingram will share her secrets of improving your soil's microbial population with compost teas at Ole Valley Organics in Reading, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what can you do with Japanese knotweed. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, and it is a knotty one. Arf, arf, arf. Japanese knotweed, one of the most invasive plants out there. Luckily, it does have some commercial uses, which you may have to turn to when we tell you how hard it is to get rid of. But we will tell you some ways to get rid of it. after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here, Kim. Where are you?
I'm in Norman, Oklahoma.
Well, I was worried we were never going to get another phone call from Norman or Oklahoma City. That tornado that blew through a couple of weeks ago was, like, historic, right? Or were you anywhere near it?
Well, it was about 5 or 6 miles north of us, where we are. And, yeah, it was close enough to be worrisome, but at our house, we hardly even got any rain and certainly no wind.
Really? That close by? You figure it'd be like an atomic blast or something?
No, it's nothing like that. I'm a research meteorologist at the National Severe Storms Laboratory, and so I've actually been out and about and seen what these things do, and it's not quite like that.
Well, you live in the right place for your job, don't you, Kim?
Yes, I certainly do. I certainly do. By the way, my wife is on the phone with us here because the garden is actually, she's the garden maven.
Oh, okay. And what can we do for you guys?
Okay. Well, my wife's name is Pam. We have a garden about 3,600 square feet. And it's in what used to be pasture land. And living in Oklahoma, Bermuda grass grows very well here. And we found that the stuff is obviously invading the garden. In fact, it grows exceptionally well in the garden. My wife wants to practice no-till gardening, and we certainly don't want to use chemicals. We don't use insecticides or anything else, you know, artificial insecticides on the garden. And we're trying to figure out a way how to get rid of this stuff. It's hideous.
Well,
it's in a lawn, but it's rotten in a garden.
I know, and that is the dichotomy. Those of us who are gardeners who could care less about lawns, we grow the nicest grass in the country, whereby people who are trying to grow a lawn are doing all the wrong things. They keep killing their grass, you know, so it's it's very frustrating. Now, that's a big garden, 3,600 feet, and is it a flat earth garden?
Yes.
See, to me, the only way, especially when you're converting, you called it pasture, we'll call it a lawn, we'll call it a day. When you're converting something like that, I think you have to have raised beds. You'll find that you'll grow twice as much with half the effort. And Oklahoma is, I realize, such a challenging area. How do you water your garden?
We're on a well, and we use that leaky hose.
Okay, good.
Pipe hose.
So you are, so far, mostly just watering your crops.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah. See, to me, this is why God made raised beds. You start in one area of your garden, and then when you get these areas up, you line the area with single sheets of cardboard, and you build raised beds on top, frames that are about a foot high. The beds are never any wider than 4 feet, and they can be as long as you want. I mean, 4x8 is a typical size, but you can make them railroad cars if you don't mind walking around them.
Sure.
And then you've got 2-foot walking lanes in between each one.
Ah, okay.
But I tell you, if you put in 4 raised beds this year, you'll never go back. You'll add 4 more every season. And what this does is it elevates your growing situation so that even if the Bermuda grass gets in to the area and starts growing in your walking lanes, it can't climb up the sides of the frames. And you've got the cardboard down on the bottom that's the barrier against the rhizomes coming up. And once you build the raised beds, then her no-till work is accomplished because you fill the beds with a nice combination of compost and topsoil, and then because they're 4 feet wide, you never step in them. You never compress the soil, so there's no need for tilling. Every year, you just add some fresh compost to the surface, and over the course of your summer, there is no work, which is especially important because your summer is fiendishly hotter
Oh, they're brutal.
Than mine is.
Yeah.
And this time, now you're just going to run the soaker hoses on the raised beds. And you're going to cover them with mulch. So you won't be watering the grass. There won't be any water going into the lanes. You're just going to water your crops, and you're going to prevent evaporation by having a nice mulch of shredded leaves or straw or something on the surface. Okay. The grass won't move in. You'll never have to till again. Every year, you make a few more raised beds. The only thing I recommend growing in flat ground are things like sweet corn and raspberries, and they can both hold their own against a little Bermuda grass. So that's it, and good luck. We're glad you didn't get badly hurt, and good luck to everybody down in Oklahoma, all our listeners down there as you rebuild, and hope that was the last one for a long, long time. 1-888-346-9499. Tracy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing very well, Tracy. How are you?
I'm doing good, thank you. I just have a few questions regarding my garden.
Okay.
I live in Glassboro, New Jersey, and I have a lot of rabbits. They tend to live in my bushes, and they eat up all my flowers, my hostas, my petunias, my marigolds. And the reason why I'm calling you is because my neighbor who lives right across the lawn from me, she has the same flowers, like hostas, and they don't touch her flowers, but they eat everything of mine. They eat my hostas. They don't eat her hostas.
Does she have a dog?
She does have a dog.
Oh, that's the difference. You don't, right?
No, I don't.
Tracy needs a dog.
I know. I knew it. My husband won't let me have one. Is that what it is? But the dog is not running loose.
It doesn't matter. They can really smell it. One interesting thing about our rabbits, the rabbits that exist in this country, is they don't burrow. There's this misconception that they're like groundhogs or gophers. But rabbits live their entire life on the surface of the soil. So a small fence, and they don't jump. So just a fence that's a foot, 18 inches, 2 feet high is enough to exclude rabbits totally. So if you put up a fence around your garden areas and then just go through and toss the rabbits on the other side or whatever, your rabbit problems will be over. But you're absolutely correct. There was a situation in Chicago in a public park where the rabbits were being trapped, and the neighbors were like, oh, don't hurt the poor little bunnies. Don't trap our rabbits. And so the city stopped trapping the rabbits. And within, I think it was 5 years, the park was gone. It had just been eaten to the ground. They have they have a ravenous appetite. And, of course, when they're in a protected area like you're providing them, they breed like rabbits. So a small fence around your gardening areas is not expensive, and it's a good answer. In the meantime, you can go out and buy deer repellent. This is a spray that whose active ingredient will be putrescent egg solids. It'll smell bad when you spray it, but it won't smell bad to you after it dries on the plants. But then rabbits won't eat it, and deer won't eat it. When you tell me that your hostas are being eaten, that tends to be more deer than rabbits.
Yeah, I don't have deers where I'm at. There's no deers.
No, you think. But you can spray repellents on the plants. There are many people who feel that human hair will keep rabbits away. So if you go to like a beauty shop, a barber shop, and you ask them to collect a lot of hair for you and use that to mulch your plants, that'll deter some rabbits. It'll certainly keep slugs away from your plants because they get tangled up in the hair and they can't survive. Or spray on repellents, or like the long-term answer, however, is a small fence. It doesn't have to be anything impressive for rabbits. But if you let them continue, they will just eat everything. So try the human hair because that's going to be for free. You also want to buy an animal repellent, specifically a deer repellent. They'll try to sell you rabbit repellent, but go for deer repellent. And spray the plants with that. That'll give them a bad taste. But sooner or later, some type of small fencing to exclude them is going to be the long-term answer.
All right, then.
All right? But that, like I said, the hair is free, and then start spraying, and then start planning your fencing.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck to you.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Japanese knotweed, one tough but edible weed. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, we got a lot of questions this week about knotweed. Would you read off the first one, please?
Sure, Mike. We heard from Khaki in Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania, who writes, I've got a quarter acre of Japanese knotweed. Is there any good use for the 10-foot-tall stalks besides making tomato trellises? Digging it up by the roots is good exercise, but I fear I'll never get anything else done, as they just keep popping up. How do I assure total elimination?
Well, you could move to one of the few remaining continents where this plant has not yet appeared, or to another planet, and don't take any garden soil with you. In other words, forget total elimination. The most you can hope for with this monster is temporary control. But as the Duct Tape Council always reminds us, all solutions are temporary.
We also heard from Scott in Stafford, Virginia, who writes, I have a bad case of Japanese knotweed. Any suggestions on eradication other than explosives?
Well, I'm sorry to negate that wonderful Elmer Fudd fantasy, but explosives would just spread the rhizomes around even faster.
Well, we also heard from Keith in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, who writes, we have Japanese knotweed taking over the stream banks that run through our property. It seems to like wet areas. It has been suggested to cut the stalks and paint the cut ends with Roundup, which I really don't want to do. Can you suggest another solution? This weed is tough and just keeps coming back year after year.
And it will keep doing so. Every article on this invasive giant carries the same warning. Once the plant gets established, it's going to take years to remove, whether the tactic is repeated cutting or the use of toxic chemical herbicides. So let's try and do this without killing millions of frogs and toads. Also known as monkey weed, donkey rhubarb, and Japanese, American, and Mexican bamboo, even though it's not a bamboo or a rhubarb, this escaped Asian ornamental especially likes to colonize the areas along stream banks, where removal becomes ecologically as well as physically problematic, as it does do a good job of holding the soil in place and preventing erosion. If it appeared next to my stream, I might first try spraying the plants repeatedly with salt water, which is a tactic recommended in one of the articles I found. Spraying towards land and using a sticker spreader to keep the salt on the plants should hopefully minimize the saline effects on the stream. Whatever you do, don't chop the plant down and let the pieces fall into the water. Experts warn that those pieces will root downstream. Now, as with running bamboo, repeated cutting of the new growth will weaken the plant. It's the rope-a-dope method of invasive eradication. You force the roots to use energy to grow shoots and then cut them down before the leaves can photosynthesize. I'm thinking the best way to achieve this would be to first reduce the size of tall stalks with pruners or a machete, pick up all the pieces, and then use a bagging lawnmower with a very sharp blade to cut the plants down low. Carefully empty the mower bag into a super thick trash bag afterwards and let it sit in the sun for a week before you put it out at the curb for pickup. Do this with any cut portions. The ability of this plant to re-root is legendary. Now repeat this cutting weekly for as long as you can deal with it, and then try a tactic suggested by landscaper David Bilieu at about.com, and try and smother the patch by covering it with overlapping pieces of old carpeting and heavy tarps. He warns that new sprouts can punch their way through solid objects. They've been known to impale concrete and undermine foundations. So you need a smothering media that is thick and heavy, but that also has some give. Keep an eye on the area and step on any new shoots you find trying to poke their way through. And no, it's not all bad. The new shoots are edible and described as tasting like a combination of rhubarb, bamboo shoots, and asparagus. Most sources suggest boiling or soaking the shoots first. And we'll link to master forager Steve Wildman Brill's detailed suggestions for consuming this abundant resource. And the roots contain extremely large amounts of resveratrol, the anti-aging, anti-dementia nutrient famously found in red wine. Harvard University wild plant expert Peter Del Tredici says that knotweed root contains such high concentrations, it's become the main commercial source of this powerful phytonutrient. And leaves of a related species called giant knotweed are the active ingredient in Regalia, a new organic control for a number of different plant diseases. So maybe consider farming that quarter acre. Finally, be ready to recognize this pest as soon as it shows up, which is often in a load of fill dirt that held tiny traces of the rhizomes. The new shoots look a bit like bamboo or asparagus and are a chartreusey red. The leaves are 4 inches long, triangular, and pointy. Pretty greenish-white flowers appear in late summer, followed by winged seed pods with lots of viable little dark seeds inside. The top growth turns brown over the winter. The plants can reach a height of 10 feet, and the rhizomes can go down an astounding 9 feet in the ground. God help us all. Well, that sure was some depressing information about Japanese knotweed now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to spray me with salt if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, just like the one you're thinking about now, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Love Train Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Thanks again to special guest Chelsea Fields from The Cook's Garden. Our home cooking editor is Al Banks. Our herbalistic intern is Jolie Higazi. The sage Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm Vulgari aficionalis Mike McGrath, and I'll mint up in time to see you again next week. Could your grass clippings be killing other plants? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how modern herbicides are turning your cut grass blades into cold-blooded killers. Plus your fabulous phone calls.